This is the Rain Report. The ham radio world lost a true pioneer, July 31st, 2000. His name was Lou McCoy. His call, W1ICP. Now, you younger hams probably won't remember him, but if you've been fooling around with antenna tuners, SWR bridges, and experienced the ever-present TVI the past 30 years, you probably already know about Lou's contributions. His mono-match and ultimate trans-match antenna tuners, his prolific writings about antennas and television interference, his prowess as a DXer working over 380 countries, but Lou is equally well-known for his stories. You're about to hear some of them. In this interview, I had the pleasure of conducting with Lou McCoy just before his 81st birthday in 1997. Here's part one of that interview.
My father was an amateur, radio amateur, too, and used to call 9LM. But my earliest, they always ask people, what's the earliest thing you can possibly remember? And I have a clear memory of being 4 years old because my father built a rotary gap transmitter, spark transmitter, and I still remember that he sat me on his lap one day and had me key that thing, and it scared the devil out of me. I didn't get into ham radio until much, much later. It was right after World War II. I was licensed in 45, 46, right at the beginning of it. I went down immediately when we could take an exam and became W9FHZ.
But why then?
I just wasn't interested in ham radio. I was interested, but I was too busy. Well, I had to go to college, and also I was doing professional entertainment as a magician, sleight of hand primarily, cards and so forth, and entertained in nightclubs, anything in those days. That was during the Depression, and you had to kind of hunt around to find some work. Worked on the WPA and things like that. But I got into ham radio in 46, as I said, and got licensed as W9FHZ. Used to sign Fanny's Handy Zipper. And I had that call in Illinois. That was in Chicago area. And became primarily a DX chaser. Never knew how much important that would be till later on in my career. But I was one of the, in fact, I was the first amateur to work DXCC on 10 meters and have it confirmed. I received the DXCC certificate post-war number 13, so that's real early.
What year was that?
That was in 48. And I have Charlie Mellon, W1FH, who was a very famous DXer, was number one. There are only two or three hams in the world who have all of the countries worked. I had them all up until just a short time ago in North Korea. I didn't work North Korea. And one of the, and that rock that off of Formosa, but I had 382 confirmed. That's a lot of confirmations, actually. I went up to the Boston Ham Fest back in 47, rather, and enjoyed myself, met a lot of famous hams there. McElroy, who held the world's record for code, I always remember going to the Mechanics Hall there in Boston, and my mouth was hanging open when I saw who it was there, because he had set a record of something like 75 per words per minute, and he was a real character. He had a bottle of, I guess it was Kentucky Moon, sitting on top of the rig, and I always remember, he says, "Hey, young man, you want to see me copy the code?" And I said, "Of course," and he had a Kleinschmidt tape machine there, and then he spewed it out at about 75 words a minute, and he just sat there and typed it out and banged it out. And I was very impressed. But when I came back to Illinois, to where I live, my neighbor, believe it or not, had bought a 5-inch TV set. And neighbors just didn't have TV sets at that time. They were only in taverns and so forth. So I tried to cure it.
You mean the TVI problems?
That's right, cure the TVI problems. But I didn't know enough at that time and how to cure it, and I finally got disgusted, and we packed up, and I moved down to Missouri. I became W0ICP, and that's the call I hold today. I held that call when I moved to the one first call area. But I stayed in Missouri for about a year and a half, and hard to find work and so forth. And for some reason, even though I chased the X yet, I got interested in 75, and I became the net control for the Missouri Emergency Phone Net. And At that time, the league, ARL, was having a real CW phone war, and they were being accused of being too much CW-oriented, and they were looking for an assistant communications manager with the title of phone activities. And I applied for it, and Ed Handy came out and interviewed me. I always remember I was very careful not to put a microphone on the desk there. I put a bug on a desk. But anyway, he hired me, and I went back to West Hartford and started my real career in ham radio. I went there in September of 48. Bud and I became good friends, and I always remember when he died, we went down there, had a very private wake, and he'd been a captain in the Coast Guard. They took him out to sea, and he wanted to be buried at sea, and they buried him out at sea. And I like to tell the guys, when you get on 15 meters, why, raise your glass and drink a toast to Bud Long, because he got you the band.
Didn't you introduce a novice class in the early to mid-50s?
Well, that was another story, and that was when Bud Long wasn't really speaking to me, but I had to go to Washington. I started to do the TVI thing, I'll tell you about that, but I had to go do a lot of traveling down to Washington and talk to the engineering section of the FCC about the TVI problems, because they were very serious, and we thought amateur radio was going to be destroyed. And George Sterling, who was at that time had just become a commissioner, he was the chief engineer of the FCC, he asked me, we went to lunch, and he asked me, and of course, I got to remember, I was only a flunky at the league in those days. I mean, just a guy that worked there, but I was going to Washington already and talking to the FCC, but he said, what would you think, McCoy, of a beginner's-type license? That I said, well, what are you talking about? He said, something to make it easier to get into ham radio. And I said, I think it'd be a great idea. And he said, what are you talking about? He said, oh, maybe 5 words a minute for code. And I always remember, I said, why don't you call it the novice license? Well, that's what they did call it. Everything seemed to tie together at that time in my history. But when I came back to the league, it was a few weeks later that they'd come out with their proposal, and Bud Long was just furious with me. I didn't know Bud like I knew him later on, but at that time, why, he just raised hell. He said, I ought to fire you, McCoy. He said, you've got no business going down to Washington and saying that the league is in favor of a novice class license. I said, I never said that. I said that he asked me what I thought of it. I said, I thought it was a good idea. He says, yeah, but you can't open your mouth without being representing the league. He said, you better find that out in a hurry, which was true, of course. That was in about 51 or 2, I think.
You're listening to RainReport.com, the only authorized internet source for Rain audio.
The TVI story is rather interesting. Phil Rand, who actually worked for Remington Rand Corporation, he was one of the Rand boys, had been more or less not hired by the league, but he was doing all his TVI work trying to find out how to cure TVI, and it consisted of, you know, tight shielding of transmitters and good filtering on the TV sets and good filtering on the amateurs to cut out the low-pass fillers and so forth. I was still working in the communications department, and I was getting pretty fed up with it. I didn't like it, and I went down. I talked to George Grammer, who was the technical director of the league, and he said at the time, he said, we can't hire you, McCoy. You got no technical background. Well, I had technical background. I had rebuilt W1AW already. The transmitters had been off the air, so I rebuilt those. And then he found out that I was a magician. That changed the whole subject, because he wanted somebody that he could send out that could, you know, get in front of an audience without falling down. And the league had a hard time finding people like that, believe me. So he hired me as a technical assistant. And I always remember, aside from the TVI stuff, he says, well, McCoy, says, you don't know a heck of a lot, so you ought to make a good novice writer, novice editor. Of course, they never called me novice editor in those days, but... So I had to write a novice article every month, sometimes two and three. I mean, so I produced an awful lot of copy, and they also gave me the job in the technical department. This was in 1951, answering technical information service, and I used to average about 5,000 letters a year, and I always remember George Grammer said, he says, don't come in and bother me with questions unless you're really stuck. He says, there's a real good library right out there, because we had a good technical library at the league. He says, you go out and find the answers. And boy, I'm telling you, you got an education, and I mean a real education in technical aspects of ham radio. The league set me up with two TV receivers and a transmitter and a whole bunch of other interference-causing devices. And I traveled and I gave a lecture in every city in the United States. This covered a period of 3 or 4 years, of every city in the United States that had low-band TV, channels 2 through 6. And then after that went out, well, I gradually started to talk on antennas because I'd been studying antennas for all those years and got to be pretty much of an expert on it. I had many, many jobs, and I was fortunate enough, I always remember George Grammer. This was in about the latter part of the 50s, 56. He called me in his office. He says, I've got a paper here from the Naval Research Labs. It's a theoretical paper on a reflectometer. And a reflectometer was something to measure RF with, but it had no details in it at all. And he said, see if you can take this article and figure out how to make an SWR bridge out of it, a reflectometer bridge. And so I didn't know where to start. And I got I'm trying to think of the name of the book, The Engineering Handbook. And I made a trough that had an inner conductor and a metal shield around it, a box. And it was a trough, and it was a 50-ohm impedance trough. And then I put a coupling device in there to detect the RF, both forward and reflected. So it was the first low-priced reflectometer for measuring standing wave ratios. And I always said I was probably the guy that made standing wave ratios a real popular subject. And I probably had more hams falling off of antennas because of that than anything else. But anyway, the Bonamatch became a standard for many years, and which is another interesting thing. If I could have patented that device, I would have been very, very wealthy. The Japs were making them and so on and so on, but it turns out that everything that we printed in QST, that when you worked at ARL, went into the public domain and became public property. It couldn't be patented. Mon hams don't know that, but oh, those were wonderful days at the league. I mean, they had the right ethics and all that.
Why were and are amateur transmitters set up for 50-ohm output?
That's a good question. What made amateur radio 50 ohms was simply that after the war, the coax surplus became available in hams. You know, with TVI, they wanted a shielded line so they could shield the RF going up to the antenna and not radiating in at television sets. So coax became extremely popular. The problem was it was also 70-ohm line, and a lot of people wanted 70 ohms. In fact, when I designed that Monomatch I'm talking about back in October of 56 and again in February of 57 in QST, I made two versions, one for 50 ohms, one for 70 ohms. Of course, 70 ohms is just really no longer used, but I think that was based on the fact that a dipole antenna has an impedance of 70 ohms, you know, above average earth and all that sort of stuff. But the 50 ohms is what they settled on. And also, there's another little clinker in there that goes back even farther. Art Collins of the famous Collins Radio, he designed the Pi Network tank circuit, which could be maneuvered to work into low impedance loads, like 50 ohms would be a low load. Yeah, relatively low compared to what we had, because we had plug-in coil transmitters and amplifiers unshielded. The thing stood out in the open. But with TVI, we had to box everything up real tight, and we had to be able to change bands, so the Pi Network lent itself very simple to a switch to change the inductance, and you could switch from band to band and keep it all shielded. So the output had to be in coax, and coax was 50 ohms.
You've just heard part one of my previously unreleased interview with ham radio pioneer, the late Lou McCoy, W1ICP, expert in the fields of antennas, antenna matching, TVI, and more. I'll include this interview with Lou McCoy, W1ICP, next time, here on the Rain Report. I'm Hap Holly, KC9RP.